They make us parents want to keep our children locked up, safe even from the daily papers that keep the grisly record of that frontier where things unspeakable happen along the highways. In today's paper, you see the teenaged girl from down the street camping in Oregon at the far point of a trip across the country. Together with another girl her age, they suffered and survived a random evil.
That's Robert Pinsky reading an excerpt from his book-length poem, An Explanation of America. Our thanks to All Things Considered and NPR for allowing us to use that excerpt. One of the teenaged girls that Pinsky refers to is Terry Jentz. Jentz is the author of Strange Piece of Paradise, A Return to the American West to Investigate My Attempted Murder and Solve the Riddle of Myself. Terry Jentz told Anne Strangechamps what happened on the night of June 22, 1977.
My roommate and I were on a cross-country bicycle trip from the West Coast to the East Coast. We had planned to ride 4,200 miles, and we were on the seventh day of our trip, camped out in a picnic area-only park in central Oregon in the desert. We had pitched our tent by the Deschutes River, had gone to sleep, and I'd say I had been asleep for about a half an hour when I woke up to the scream of tires and a terrifically heavy weight on my body, and I deduced that I had been run over by a truck. I was listening for sounds that would tell me that it was an accident, and the sounds I heard told me the opposite. My friend started to scream, "Leave us alone." Clearly she had seen somebody, and then I heard several blows, and then she was obviously knocked unconscious. At that point I realized we were in fact being murdered, and the driving over the tent had been intentional. I was underneath the wheel of a truck. I knew it, and I knew I was being murdered and could barely gasp for breath. But at that point, I heard sounds, and this individual got back into the truck and pulled off of me, thereby allowing me to breathe again. But my moment of reprieve was short because he soon came back and started bludgeoning me with a weapon, and I wasn't certain what it was. I was thrashing from side to side, starbursts in my head, and my consciousness was ebbing away, and I realized that I was dying. And I was barely 20, had actually not reached my 20th birthday, and there was a voice inside me that said, "You're being murdered. Wait a minute. Why are you allowing him to do this?" And so I decided at that moment, some voice deep inside me, to make a bid for my life. And so I struggled to get my consciousness back. I opened my eyes to see what was there, and I looked up at a man standing over me with a hatchet. He was a cowboy, meticulously dressed in cowboy attire, and I couldn't see his face because it dissolved in darkness. But I looked up at him, and he brought the axe down. I caught it in my hands just above my heart, and I said, "Please take anything, but go away. Just leave us alone." I had heard my roommate scream just a minute before, and I knew that screams were not going to work with this guy. So that's why I used such a calm tone of voice. And miraculously, he withdrew the hatchet from my hands slowly and stepped over me, got back into his truck, and squealed away.
One of the few pieces of good to come out of the whole story, the attack and your subsequent return to Oregon to try to find out more about it, is your discovery that, in fact, the townspeople, the community, had also, like you, not forgotten this attack. That must have been really surprising.
It was extraordinarily surprising. I found that this story was an open wound for this community. They described how they'd been devastated by it, how this experience had sculpted them as individuals often, and as a community. It was the loss of innocence. They described it as the first murder in a little town, even though it wasn't a murder. It was everything but. They considered it a murder. In fact, a lot of them had thought we had died, and I was like the ghost coming back. It was very bizarre.
And they'd never found the person who did it.
They never solved the crime. No one was ever arrested for the crime, but they had a very, many of them believed they did know who did it. In fact, an overwhelming number of people in the community believed. They believed a 17-year-old kid who was a meticulous cowboy at the time, who was known for his volatile temper and for beating his girlfriend, was in fact the one who most likely perpetrated the crime against me and Shayna. And in fact, the very next day after the crime on us, he tried to kill his girlfriend in a state of just unbelievable rage.
If it was sort of an open secret in the community that this is the person who did it, why was he never arrested?
Well, that's a mystery that I never was entirely able to solve. Certainly, the investigation was shoddy at best and corrupt at worst. I think, though, that if you really boil down the issue, if enough people in the town had been calling the police saying, we think this guy did it and this is why, it probably would have broken through, you know, even the incompetence of that police force. But it's odd. They had their suspicions, but they didn't make any phone calls.
So you had spent all these years reading your own history as a story of survival. It must have been a huge kind of sea change to turn around and go back to the scene of the crime and revisit what was in fact a moment of extraordinary vulnerability.
I think that that's an excellent point. I had no idea of what really had happened to me. I was in a classic case of denial, in fact, suffering from classic symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. And as the years went on, that kind of feeling of being anointed, that feeling of immortality, of specialness, started to morph into something quite different, which was that I was a ball of fear. I had lessening of my earlier vitality. I had repetitive dreams, all symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. And so when I went back in 1992 to investigate this crime and the circumstances that led up to it and the aftermath, part of it was to free myself of what had turned into paralysis. And I think, getting back to your point, part of the paralysis was not understanding what had happened to me, having really no compassion for my own injuries, for my own woundedness, for the degree to which I had been vulnerable. And so I had to look through other people's eyes who were able to describe to me from their point of view what I was like, how they perceived me, like the woman who picked me up on the road, Boo, finding her and having her describe how she perceived me, finding the nurses and having them describe how they perceived me was part of opening up my compassion for myself.
How did they describe you? I mean, did they show you things, create a picture that was something other than what you knew or what you'd expected?
I hadn't really bothered to visualize it. So when I heard Boo talk about how she saw me coming to the window of the car, dripping in blood, bathed in blood, that was quite startling to me. I didn't even know my arm had been chopped through, and she saw that. She described that it was chopped like a piece of wood, like you'd see a hatchet chopping a stump. Quite a startling image. The nurses described to me tire tracks on my leg. They described, you know, again, my chopped arm as being, you know, like a series of defensive wounds, something that was so shocking to them that they, you know, they've never gotten over it. The devastation of seeing what a human being could do to another human being. I mean, that was the other thing that I just couldn't quite take in, is that my body was kind of, for other people, an object lesson in what a human being could do to another human being. You know, I had sort of divorced my own wounds from, you know, this individual who had created them. And I really took a great effort of will to go back and say, yes, this man... And I do believe I solved that crime, and I do believe it is that 17-year-old that everyone suspected. This man created these wounds. He had that degree of malevolence, which then leads to the understanding of evil in human nature, which is quite a hard pill to swallow.
Tell me about the man everybody else in town and you came to believe actually did it. It must have been, I can't imagine what it must have been like to finally see the person you think nearly killed you.
Well, you know, I spent a number of years piecing together evidence, and I finally collected enough evidence to believe that he was, in fact, my attacker. During those years, I had one man offer to set him up in a restaurant so that I could take a look at him to see if there was anything that matched my memory. So I was able to watch him, and he didn't know that I was sitting there. And that was the first time I laid eyes on him. It was not a scary experience. It was, I suppose I'd say, exciting, because I had the drop on him instead of the other way around, finally. And when I looked at him, I couldn't say that I recognized him, because I don't remember his face, but I did recognize a quality of meticulousness and a quality of charisma. And he was certainly a very well-built, well-proportioned guy. And I remembered I remember saying to everyone I told the story to, he was a very attractive young man. That registered on me even as I was under the hatchet. I mean, that's how much attention he paid to his appearance. And that's the kind of guy I saw in front of me in the restaurant, to the point where he was so meticulous that I could see the marks that the comb had made in his freshly washed hair.
What's the closest moment of contact you've had with him?
He was in the courtroom for a crime that, thanks to the attention that I and my allies, the crime victims group and the police, put on him. Finally, the DA took his malevolence very seriously, and he ended up getting indicted for holding a gun on his hunting partner. And he was in a courtroom in 1997, and I watched this trial. And the closest I ever came to him was out in the hall. He was obviously trying to get my attention and sort of trying to position himself near me. I don't know whether he wanted to talk to me or whether to convince me that he wasn't the guy, or whether he was curious about me. I don't know. But I came almost face to face with him at one point. But I remember noting that his energy was not trying to scare or intimidate me. It was the opposite. He was trying to feign innocence with me. But I would give him no airspace. I just walked away.
Wasn't it during that trial that you deliberately sat with your scarred arm visible and, in fact, highlighted the scars with lipstick?
I did do that. I took my lipstick liner and highlighted my scar, sat right in front of him, and the woman who rescued me, Boo, and I were sitting in front of him, and I stretched my arm out behind the back of her chair and put my scar right in his eye line, and then I kind of turned around and was able to, you know, get a bit of a sense of how he was reacting to that.
What did you want? Why did you do that?
You know, people say, do you feel vengeful? Do you want to torture this guy? Would you like to see him get the death penalty? All these kind of things. And I always say, you know, no, I would like to see him in jail for the rest of his life. But I also wanted him to know that I knew he had done it and that he was not able to fool me. I think that was the primary reason for that, because he's tried to convince people over and over and over again. It's not going to work. It's not going to work on me. You know, we know you did it. You can't be convicted anymore, but you did it, and we know. That was the message. It was a way of holding him accountable.
And did that work?
Which is vitally important.
I mean, did that give you what you were looking for, some kind of sense of closure?
I don't think closure is a word that ought to be entered into our lexicon anymore. I think closure is implies you get something and then you move on. But I think actually what you do is integrate it into your life. So holding him accountable is not giving me closure. What it's doing is helping me feel like, yes, I've had some version of justice, which I think is vital for the psyche. But I also think that, you know, by putting that in the book, I'm encouraging other people to hold their oppressors accountable. And I think that my version of closure is not putting it behind me, but taking action on behalf of the collective, on behalf of society, to inspire others to take similar acts of courage to hold their perpetrators accountable.
I suppose to take the power back, to go back to
talking
about
power. Back. And so if that were just for me, my own little ritual, and I wasn't writing about it, I may not have even done it. But I knew that I was writing a book, and I knew that this would be a symbolic act. So my version of closure, again, is not putting it behind me. It's integrating it and using it and transmuting it into action on behalf of others. And so I wanted that whole trial scene in my book where I confront him in the hallway and with my scar, confront him silently. I wanted that to be a symbolic gesture of standing up to the perpetrator and saying, you did it, I hold you accountable, you haven't gotten away with it, we know, the world knows. This is vitally important. This kind of justice is vitally important to restoring the balance.
Terry Jentz is the author of Strange Piece of Paradise, a return to the American West to investigate my attempted murder and solve the riddle of myself. She spoke with N. Strange Champs.